This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kirsten Dunst, is one of the stars of the new film, The Power of the Dog, which is streaming on Netflix. It's been turning up on many 10 best lists, including Justin Chang's, our film critic, who called the film a magnificent Western psychodrama. Dunst was described in the November issue of Vogue as the current frontrunner for 2022's Best Supporting Actress Oscar. She got her start in movies at age 8 in Bonfire of the Vanities. At 11, she played a vampire in Interview with the Vampire. She's starred in arthouse films like Lars von Trier's Melancholia and Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides and Marie Antoinette, as well as in more mainstream films like Bring It On and the Spider-Man movies. Her new film, The Power of the Dog, was directed by Jane Campion and is set in Montana in 1925. Dunst plays a widow who runs a small inn in a one-street town with the help of her son, who's a young adult. Two brothers, played by Benedict Cumberbatch and Jesse Plemons, who own a ranch, are leading a cattle drive herding the cattle to market. On the way, they stop at Dunst's Inn and Dining Hall. Cumberbatch is macho and is condescending and nasty to others, including his brother. Plemons is soft-spoken and businesslike. When Dunst's son serves them dinner, Cumberbatch mocks him for being effeminate. Plemons stays to pay the bill and finds Dunst in tears, upset by how Plemons' brother treated her son. Plemons soon marries her and brings her back to the ranch, where his brother torments her and her son when he visits. The story has many surprising twists and turns as Campion explores the image of rugged masculinity that Cumberbatch embodies and slowly reveals what's going on beneath that surface. Although Dunst is living on the ranch in a well-appointed home, home offers no comfort as she's constantly insulted and ridiculed by Cumberbatch, becomes increasingly lonely and depressed, and turns to alcohol. In a New York Times review of the film, A.O. Scott wrote, "Few performers can break your heart like Dunst, whose face becomes a landscape of pain as all Rose's initial happiness drains away." This is the second time that Dunst has starred opposite her now husband, Jesse Plemons, with whom she has two children. The first time was on the FX series Fargo. Kirsten Dunst, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
Your character, Rose, starts as incredibly capable. And as her situation changes and she goes to the ranch and feels isolated and alone and ridiculed, she becomes profoundly depressed. Did you behave differently when you were on set but not on camera? You know, when you're just like waiting to be called. When you were capable, when your character was capable versus when your character was depressed?
Yes, that definitely rubs off into the way that you are on set. I don't consciously do that unless I feel the need that I have to really isolate for some reason. Like in the dinner scene with the parents that come to visit, I remember not talking much that day, just so that the first time that I spoke, my voice sounded really, like, choked up. You know, like there was a lump in my throat, which it worked. It didn't end up in the film, but it happened, so that was it was worth it. But Benedict and I, we didn't talk on set, which it was helpful. We didn't have many scenes together, but it was just, I think those things that are helpful for him as an actor also helped set, bring another energy to the set as well.
The movie made me think, among other things, about what marriage was like then for a lot of people. I mean, Jesse Plemons' character proposes to you because, you know, you seem like a very nice, very decent, very caring individual, and he kind of needs a wife. And you enthusiastically say yes because you're a widow or you're on your own, basically in the middle of nowhere, and you could really use a husband. And, I mean, you have feelings for each other, but it's not like it is now where you really get to know a person beforehand and maybe you move in together and before you actually get married. So it made me think about that distance between many people as they're getting married. But it also made me think about how well you know Jesse Plemons and how well he knows you, because you actually are married and you're playing these two people who are very careful around each other because you hardly know each other.
Yes, for me, that what they recognize immediately in their souls as characters is that they both have such a deep loneliness. And there's kindness there that, you know, yeah, but it's you know, it would be improper to live together before getting married.
Oh, of course. And, yes, right.
Yeah, and she's a wit, and, you know, yeah, all of those things. And in terms of Jesse's and my relationship, yeah, it's funny to have a child together and then be so proper and reserved with each other within the scenes. It was very sweet, you know. I'm happy that being on that mountaintop, to me, I almost feel like it's just like a cinematic love letter to our children one day or something. It just, to be able to be in a Jane Campion movie together, first of all, just being in a Jane Campion, and then to be in it with your husband it was very special. I'll never forget this time. And also Jesse and I we love working with each other. So it's the ideal situation. And he's my favorite actor to work with.
Why?
Well, we fell in love creatively first, I think, in Fargo. We just immediately clicked in the way we approach things and don't judge each other, and not in it for anything but trying to create the most real thing. There's no competition. There's no ego. There's a sharing of ideas. And we were very present with each other. And when you have that, it's very exciting to act with a person when they're as free and want to explore things with you and change things and surprise each other. And so we had that immediately. I mean, we'd rehearsed almost every night running lines together because the dialogue in Fargo was very, there was a lot of musicality to it, and a lot of, because it's a dark comedy, it was a lot of like little quick back and forth. So we worked really hard together and we really enjoyed it and inspired each other. So I think the first step in our relationship was falling in love creatively.
Is it ever strange to see somebody you know so well be somebody else? You know, like when they're in character.
Again, George and Rose, like, we have such limited scenes together, and a lot was cut out too. I think in the edit, when I first watched The Power of the Dog, I was surprised at how, like, economized the film had become, but also it had such a better pace and such a better, like, edge-of-your-seat feeling of this energy that I think would have gone away if you had a lot of the scenes that we had filmed, like me telling George that I don't think his brother likes me and things like that, kind of let the air out of the tension. And there was a scene where I also asked Benedict, like, in like kind of a broken doll, kind of drunky situation, you know, why don't you like me, basically. And those things were cut out, and I think it's good for the feeling and the mystery of the film.
A lot of people want to work with Jane Campion, which, of course, you got to do when she directed you in The Power of the Dog. Is there something special about her directing technique that you can talk about?
Jane is someone who, well, her films have inspired me tremendously from an acting standpoint, just the female performances, the courage of them. That has been a huge inspiration for me as an actress. So I knew to be a part of one of her films would be that I could be one of those women, you know what I mean, in one of her movies. When I was in my early 20s, she wrote me a letter about possibly working together on a film and developing, workshopping this short film. It never came to fruition, but I kept the letter in my email. And so it had been a dream of mine for a long time, but, you know, you never know. Great directors make a movie like every, you know, not very often. So, you know, what you give her and what she wants the unfiltered truth. She wants the ugly. She wants the real. She doesn't need to see women in a pretty light, you know? And that's the kind of people that I want to work with too, because I don't find it interesting to play other types of roles. So to me, working with her meant ultimate acting freedom, and that she'll choose the takes and the performance that feels the most real and raw and you know. One thing she does, which is kind of funny, is she'll act along in the scene. When I'd watch her and say I wasn't in the scene, but I was on set and watching, she'll like say the dialogue. She's actually a really good actress, which is very funny. When we were improvising and like the old lady and the old gent, when they weren't, you know, there to rehearse and the scenes and things like that, Jane would play all the characters and she'd play them so well. So when she's writing, I'm sure she acts it out, which makes a lot of sense.
That's really interesting.
So that's something that it's almost like like when you have a stage mom and they're like mouthing the words to you when you're up on stage. It's a little bit like that. Like she's like so in the scene with you, but also kind of a little bit acting it out and like getting joy from the way you say it. And watching her watch us is really fun.
Can I ask how you first met your husband, Jesse Plemons, with whom you star in The Power of the Dog and with whom you starred in a season of Fargo?
I met Jesse at the airport at LAX, and I walked up to him, and he was carrying a carton of cigarettes, and I was like, oh, no, you smoke the cigarettes that I used to smoke, and I quit. So we just knew that, like, working with someone that smoked, and I was just like, oh, God, please don't become a smoker again on this show. But, yeah, I remember seeing his eyes and our eyes meeting, and I still remember to this day. And it's happened to me very occasionally in life where I, like, really have that moment of remembering our eye connection of meeting for the first time.
How did you meet at the airport? Were you just both there, or?
We're both flying to Calgary to shoot the show.
Oh,
so we were on the
I
same
see.
Flight.
I see. Mm-hmm. Did you sit next to each other?
No, we didn't sit next to each other. But when we got off the plane, I knew to rush to get my worker's permit to work in Canada. So I knew, like, get off the plane and just go get it because the line can really, like, pile up and then you're stuck there for an hour. So I was, like, running to get there. And I saw Jesse was at the behind the line. And I was like, come up, come up. I didn't want him to feel. We were playing husband and wife, and I'm someone who just, like, wanted to have an ally immediately and wanted to have a friend because we were going to be working really intimately together. And so I, you know, I pulled him up. I was like, come cut with me. And that was the beginning.
Is he still smoking?
No, we're not. No.
Good. And you didn't start because you were around him?
I did.
Oh, that's hard. It's really hard.
Sets are the worst. It's just the worst. It's like a moment to yourself. It's the worst habit and the worst place to be, you know. Yeah, it's just the worst. It's like the only time people leave you alone, you know, because they're always like on their walkie-talkies, like, she went 10-1, she went 10-1. It's like you can only go to the bathroom, really, to like not be around people. So smoking on set becomes kind of like a break from everybody.
How did you both stop?
Children.
Oh, yeah. You started working when you were how old? Was it 3? Do I have that right?
I'm from New Jersey, and we'd drive into New York, and I'd start, I did little kid modeling at 3.
What were you modeling?
Like clothes and things like that. Just, I was a Ford model for their baby division, and I would just, you know, do catalog shoots. Eventually, they were like, she should get a commercial agent. It's kind of the next step, and I booked the first commercial I went on, which was Kick Cereal, so it was kind of like, you know, a no-brainer to everybody that, oh, she also can, you know, act like she likes cereal.
Whose idea was it that you should become a model at age 3?
Well, my mom would just be in the grocery store and things, and people would come up and be like, your daughter's so cute, you should try little kid modeling. And she thought, you know, why not? Like, I think that it was, New York was close, and at first it was just fun to do and put away some college money, you know, and not really, you know, just like a fun thing for her to do with me, going to New York. And she got told I was cute enough times to go try and do something about it, I guess. I don't know. I think also that attention as a mother is probably, you know, so if people are always saying how, like, cute your kid is, you kind of feel maybe the pressure to do something about it, maybe?
No, I think you were 8 when you were in Bonfire of the Vanities with Tom Hanks, and 11, Interview with the Vampire with Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise. I mean, these are big movies. Did you get good advice from the adults you were working with?
Well, on Interview with the Vampire, I was treated like a little princess. Like, Tom and Brad, they were just so lovely to me, and everyone protected me on that set, and I felt very safe. And then after that, after working with like the biggest men in the industry, I got to work with the biggest women in the industry doing Little Women. So that shift was really, I think, such a good education that I wasn't even really aware of. And kind of because I worked with Gillian Armstrong, who directed Little Women right after Interview with the Vampire, it really, I think, you know, going from Neil Jordan to then her, I never really had any thought about female director, male director. Like, I think that kind of just set me up for life of not really worrying about or thinking, you know, oh, I'm working with a female director. Or so that I think was very helpful in my education of the industry and film and my own kind of all my experience, because I worked with Susan Sarandon and Claire Danes and Winona Ryder, and you know, it just was really exciting to work with like some of the best actresses right after you work with some of the best actors. You know, it was a very good unconscious learning experience, I think, for me, because I wasn't clocking that. I was just experiencing it. But I think that getting into my system so young was very helpful to be around these strong women like Susan Sarandon.
Are there like gender differences in how you were treated or what the atmosphere was like?
I think the most on Spider-Man, maybe, because I was playing the girl, you know, the quintessential girl. I mean, even the first AD called me girly girl. It was like, it annoyed me, but I never said anything. And then I worked with him again. I was like, you know, that really annoyed me. And he was like, I'm so sorry. But yeah, I didn't really feel that way, I think, until I entered my late teens, you know, where it felt a little bit more like that. But also, I was playing, you know, Spider-Man's girlfriend.
What do you think he meant by girly girl when he called you that?
I think, you know, I was the only girl on the set. It was just like, it felt dismissive. It felt a little, you know, like, I don't know. It just felt like, yeah, a little bit like dismissive and disrespectful of me as an actress on the set.
When you were 16, you worked with Sofia Coppola for the first time, and it was her first outing as a director. This is on the film Virgin Suicides. What did it mean to you to have a young woman directing you? And you were still getting your footing in the industry, but you'd been in it since you were a child, and she was born into the industry, but this was something brand new for her, directing. So how did you connect with each other?
Sophia was always, to me, when I was younger, an older sister that I looked up to and somebody who I really admired. Because again, I was getting these lessons on Virgin Suicides that I realized later in life how it influenced me on, you know, what beauty looks like to people and how women perceive that as opposed to men and how she viewed me. And she kind of gave me my first role where I was seen as someone who was sexual, and but this was done through a female lens, which is, I think, set me up for like a really positive at 16, when you don't feel good about yourself, or you pick things apart, whatever a 16-year-old we do to ourselves, she gave me a confidence that I think this industry can really eat at, or want to change you or make you the perfect blonde or something like that. And she liked all my imperfections, and she liked the things that later in life people wanted me to change.
Like your teeth. Tell us the teeth story.
One of the producers on Spider-Man took me to her dentist once to try and get me to fix my little fangs, basically. and Sophia always, she loves my teeth so much. She's like, don't ever fix your teeth. And when one of her daughters has a little bit of teeth like mine too, she just loves crooked teeth. And, you know, when the coolest girl, when you think you're, you know, your cool older sister figure in your life, you know, thinks crooked teeth is cool, then, you know, it's like Kate Moss has crooked teeth. You know, it's like I never wanted to be, whenever I tried to fit myself into this romantic comedy thing or to fit myself into some kind of ideal of an actress in this business, it always ended up not feeling good. So the pressure of that, I'm not into, and the vanity of it.
Mm-hmm. My understanding of the story is that the producer drove you to the dentist without telling you what this was about, then told you you were going to get your teeth fixed and you didn't get out of the car, and said that you weren't going to do it.
She did it very subtly.
Oh, okay. But how did you summon up the courage to say no to the producer of this blockbuster movie you were about to be in?
It wasn't as dramatic. I went, she said, oh, you should go to my dentist. Just like, oh, here's a dentist. And I was like, okay, like, I guess I should get my teeth cleaned in Beverly Hills instead of the Valley. You know what I mean? I don't know. I would think I just was like, okay. So I went to her fancy Beverly Hills doctor, and then they suggested it there. And it was kind of like a suggestion, I think, you know, based on, you know, her. I think even in the second Spider-Man poster, my teeth are straighter, for sure. They straighten my teeth.
What's your reaction to that?
I mean, I knew it right away when I saw the poster. I was just like, I mean, honestly, I thought it was pretty cool that I was on the poster at first. And then I was like, oh, they fixed my teeth. And I was like, whatever. I mean, it didn't surprise me. It just didn't surprise me. That's all. It's just like, that was more of an airbrushing era though, too. Now everybody wants like, well, not on Instagram, obviously, but like in terms of representation of people in magazines, it seems to have somewhat gone to a more realistic woman rather than, you know, an airbrush perfect image of someone. So
let me make a counter argument, which is instead of getting airbrushed in photographs, well, people are still getting Photoshop, but also people are having work done. So like you don't even need to be airbrushed because a surgeon airbrushed you already.
Yeah, no, I know. It's all because of these Instagram filters. People want to then look like a filter in real life, which it's very depressing. I'm happy I don't have two little girls right now, to be honest. Like, I mean, men do it too, but it's less so. I feel like it's something that I know that if I ever did, I'll always be able to work and work on good things if I don't mess with my face. I know that. I'll get better roles.
Why do you say that?
Because the real actresses, like, that are, I don't know, the ones that I look up to, they don't look crazy. And they can move their faces. I mean, look at Frances McDormand. Like, all the, you know, Laura Dern. I mean, the people that I love, like, they don't mess with their face.
Well, one last question. Does your mother feel like she was really, like, a prophet or a genius in getting you into, you know, modeling when you were three and then leading the way toward acting? I mean, you've really found a home in that.
Mm-hmm. No, of course. As a mother, even Jesse's mother, it's funny because he was a child actor as well. So both of them are like, you know, I'm like, you really must be, yeah, they must be very proud of themselves. We joke that they should start their own children's agency. They're dying to take our son out, like sneakily to like audition for, just because they have that in them. They've got it in them. It's really funny. But yes, Jesse and I were both child actors, so I think that probably bonds us deeper in some ways as well.
Oh, sure. Well, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Kirsten Dunst is one of the stars of the new film, The Power of the Dog, which is streaming on Netflix. Our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, has a remedy for the post-holiday blahs. It's a new suspense novel called The Latinist. Here's her review.
It's early January, a dismal time here in the Northeast, and of course, the pandemic rages on. I think that's enough of an explanation for why I just want to hibernate and read mysteries for a while. Fortunately, the new year is starting off strong with a superb debut suspense novel by Mark Prinz called The Latinist that's lightly reminiscent of Donna Tartt's 1992 debut, The Secret History. Like Tartt's novel, The Latinist is set in the claustrophobic world of academia and is saturated with references to classical mythology. And like the best thrillers, The Latinist is ingenious in its sinister simplicity. Here's the premise. A PhD candidate in classics at Oxford named Tessa Templeton is a rising star in her small field, namely the work of a minor Roman poet named Marius. So it's odd that some of the more humdrum graduate students in her program have landed job interviews, while Tessa has received none. Still, when Tessa receives an anonymous email with a thumbnail photo of a devastating recommendation letter that her advisor has written for her, Tessa thinks it must be a practical joke. Why would her supportive advisor, Professor Christopher Eccles, write a letter filled with such buzzkill phrases as, "Tessa has made strides from a rocky beginning to her doctorate," and "Sometimes Tessa is hindered by a tendency to be argumentative"? Professor Eccles' motive, we quickly learn, is obsession. He wants to keep Tessa close, toiling beside him as an adjunct at Oxford. As the truth of Eccles' erotic fixation emerges, Tessa realizes that she's as trapped as any noir character caught in Nightmare Alley. After all, her career rests in the hands of the very man who's trying to flatten it. If your stomach clenched upon hearing that opening situation, then you're probably familiar with the mean streets and dead ends of graduate school, particularly in disciplines like classics, where the job prospects are so infinitesimal that competition is particularly cutthroat. To free herself from the trap Eccles has placed her in, Tessa must do what she does best, outthink her predatory thesis advisor. The Latinist is especially fun if you like your mysteries brainy. Prinz vividly conveys the fascination of the arcane, coaxing us readers deep into the weeds of Tessa's research into Marius's work. Tessa has also distinguished herself by writing a soon-to-be-published paper on the Daphne and Apollo myth. That's the ancient Greek story, set down most memorably by the Roman poet Ovid in his Metamorphoses, where the nymph Daphne escapes sexual violation by the god Apollo by transforming into a laurel tree. Clearly, the Latinist itself is a clever updating of the Daphne and Apollo myth, a modern tale of coercive power and last-minute changes of fortune. As it goes on, this academic suspense story also changes shape, mutating into something closer to Agatha Christie's murder in Mesopotamia after Tessa flees Oxford and attaches herself to an archaeological dig near Rome. There, working largely in solitude in an eerie necropolis, she makes a spectacular discovery that just might invert the power dynamic between her and her grasping mentor. Prinz's evocative writing style makes the Latinist more than just a diverting contrivance. Here, for instance, is a mythologically inflected description of a visit that Professor Eccles pays to his mother, who's just been transferred to a nursing home. She's been diagnosed with dementia, another kind of metamorphosis. The elevator dinged at the first floor, and at the third he stepped out, following room numbers through a labyrinth of hallways. He thought of Theseus in the labyrinth, trailing Ariadne's thread behind him so that he could find his way back out when he killed the Minotaur. He was Theseus, confronting nothing less frightening, a parent. How would he get out of this? Another door, another hallway, new voices. Let this journey continue, Eccles thought. I'd love to never get there. The grotesque metamorphosis that brings this novel to a close might have earned the notice of Ovid himself. Like the classics that inspire it, the Latinist is an inventive wedding of the elegant and the barbaric.
Maureen Carrigan is a professor of literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Latinist by Mark Prinz. Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. Here's Dave.
You've no doubt noticed that one of the impacts of the pandemic is that it's just harder to buy stuff. Not everything, but there have been price spikes and shortages of big-ticket items like cars and building materials, as well as products as common as toilet paper, Nutella, and cream cheese. The shortages are due in part to disruptions in the global supply chain, a phrase few of us were using before last year. Our guest, Wall Street Journal columnist Christopher Mims, has a new book which takes a close look at the complex network of technology and people that make up that supply chain. He follows a hypothetical USB charger from the Vietnamese factory where it's made to its delivery to a home in Connecticut, a journey that traverses 14,000 miles and 12 time zones. It involves barges, shipping containers, trucks, and warehouses, employing countless people, robots, and miles of travel on conveyor belts. MIMS examines the sophisticated technology and work rules that squeeze every ounce of inefficiency out of these processes and their sometimes punishing effects on the workers that toil in the system. Christopher MIMS is a technology columnist at The Wall Street Journal who has a degree in neuroscience and behavioral biology from Emory University. Previously, he was a correspondent and editor for Quartz. He's also been an editor at Scientific American, Technology Review, and Smithsonian. His new book is called Arriving Today, From Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy. Christopher MIMS, welcome to Fresh Air. You started researching this book, beginning in Vietnam, where this product that you follow is manufactured. And by coincidence, I guess, it was in March 2020, just as the pandemic was becoming a global threat. But you didn't set out, obviously, to do a book about these disruptions in the supply chain that have made so much news lately. You thought the supply chain in normal times, when it functions as intended, is a story worth telling. Why?
A big part of it is that there has just been so much change and disruption in the global supply chain, in how things get from the factory to our front door. Obviously, a big part of that is e-commerce and Amazon. And so, frankly, if you want to look at how automation is affecting workers all over the world, I think there's no better place to look than, you know, delivery and warehouses. There's just so much transformation happening there. There are so many robots being employed. But it turns out you can't really tell that story without looking at the entire global supply chain, because kind of laid atop that narrative is this century-long change in where things are made and how they get to us.
Right. And with these disruptions, which you mentioned, not the disruptions of the pandemic, but just the way things have been revolutionized in freight, transport, and distribution, things are just so much cheaper to get long distances. You cite an example of codfish caught off Scotland. Tell us about this.
It turns out that the cod that are caught off the coast of Scotland are shipped to China or Southeast Asia, where they're filleted, because, of course, the labor cost is much lower there, and then shipped back to Scotland. Obviously, they're frozen along the way. So it's a journey of many thousands of miles, because transporting that cod is so much cheaper than, you know, paying domestic workers to prepare that cod.
So we've got freight transport across oceans so efficient that I think you said it. You can send a television across the Pacific for a fee of what, a couple bucks?
Yeah. I mean, before the pandemic, you could send a large screen television, you know, in a shipping container port to port from China to the port of Los Angeles for $2. Obviously, that's because you're sending it in a shipping container that's stuffed full of these televisions. Also, obviously, that cost has gone up substantially during the pandemic. But that, you know, for many years has been the norm. It's just that cheap to ship something, even if it's large.
All right. So let's take a look at this journey that you chronicle here. I mean, this USB charger, which is your metaphor for this product that's going to go all the way through the supply chain, is manufactured in Vietnam. Vietnam has a huge manufacturing industry now. A lot of stuff in China has moved to other places because labor is expensive and they have a huge market of their own. What's interesting, though, is that a lot of these manufactured finished goods, when they're manufactured in Vietnam, don't travel to port by rail or truck. How do they go?
Well, Vietnam is blessed with, of course, a very elaborate river system. They don't have a lot of road and rail infrastructure, but in some ways they don't need it. So what happens in Vietnam is that there are a lot of factories where they finish goods, they stuff them into a truck or a shipping container, and then that is immediately put onto a small barge. And, you know, it only holds about 80 shipping containers, and a shipping container is about 8 feet tall and 40 feet long. And then those shipping containers are shipped down the river, down the Saigon River, to a port, which faces, of course, the Pacific Ocean. And there they are transferred onto the ocean-going giants, the very large ocean-going shipping containers, which, you know, we've all seen images of.
People know that, you know, shipping containers have kind of revolutionized maritime freight transport. Give us a sense of their dimensions and the scale at which they are shipped. I mean, how big are these ships? How many containers can they carry? What does it look like?
picture the Empire State Building laid on its side. It's almost exactly those dimensions. I mean, the largest of them, the very largest, you can put four soccer pitches on their deck and still have a little bit of room left over. But you're talking about a vessel that, you know, from the waterline to the top is 15 stories tall. And the biggest of them can carry, you know, 10,000 40-foot shipping containers. And it's their size, it's their scale, which makes shipping so cheap and so efficient because, you know, the more goods you're moving all at once because of the physics of, you know, putting them on a ship and moving them on the water, which turns out to be the most efficient way we've ever invented to move goods, it just drives the cost down by making these ships bigger and bigger.
Tell us a bit about the lives of crew members.
To be a crew on a modern ship that's moving shipping containers has jokingly been compared to, you know, being in prison, but it's only sort of half joking. It's like you're living in an office building that you can never leave. You're going to see sunset and sunrise, and they might be stunning, but you're sort of confined to the bridge, especially if you're an officer, you know, and your job is managerial and you're doing navigation. And, you know, if you're in so-called able-bodied seaman, you might be walking the ship doing repairs. But the other joke about this is, you know, become a sailor, travel around the world, see none of it. Because when these ships arrive in port, that whole process is so swift, so automated. You know, these ships can be turned around in as little as 24 hours. These sailors might not even have a chance to leave the ship when they arrive in port. And yet they might be in a 6-month round trip journey halfway around the world. And so, you know, the life of a modern sailor is, you know, I think in some ways it's very lonely. They're not allowed to drink on board. They're very rarely going ashore. It's strangely kind of an office job on the high seas.
Right. And the crews aren't big, right? You can have as few as 30 people running one of these container vessels.
Yeah, you can have less than 20. I mean, at minimum, these ships need maybe a dozen people for a skeleton crew. But, you know, the size of the crews keep shrinking even as the ships keep growing.
And lately, when you've had ships that have been unable to dock because of the backups at ports, are the sailors just simply captive for weeks or months?
They are. And, you know, it's one thing to be stuck at the port of Los Angeles, you know, off the coast of California. I mean, that's unpleasant. And that can really throw a spanner into people's lives and livelihoods. But keep in mind that there are ports everywhere in the world. And you know, at the Wall Street Journal, we have reported on sailors being trapped on ships, you know, sometimes for many months beyond what should be the end of their contract. I mean, this has really been a global crisis where crews can't get off these ships, not just because of the congestion, but because of COVID and because of, you know, difficulty in traveling internationally as different countries shut down or open up or change their rules about who can come in. I mean, it's sometimes very hard to be a sailor who has one nationality and try to get off a ship in a totally different country and then fly back to your country of origin.
So they're just stuck for the longest time and with really no recourse?
Yes. At its worst, it was more than 100,000 sailors all over the world at sort of the most acute point of the pandemic were being held on ships beyond the end of their contracts. That has eased up to some extent and has gotten better, but you know, it really has been a crew change crisis for a long time.
Why are so many ships now stacked up outside the port of Los Angeles? What's going on there?
The short answer is that building more infrastructure for shipping of any kind, whether it's trucking or ocean-going shipping, takes time. And ports especially take decades if you want to expand their capacity. So basically, Americans went on a shopping spree as soon as lockdown started, and we haven't really stopped since. And so we are ordering so much stuff, and we have transferred so much of our spending from services, right, like hospitality, going on vacations, eating out, to goods, that it has really jammed up the works of the global supply chain. And as soon as one ship gets delayed, there's just this cascading effect where more and more ships get delayed. And because they're all on these tight schedules where they need to be at the Port of Los Angeles today, but in, you know, 2 to 4 weeks, they need to be back in, you know, Shanghai or wherever. If they get delayed at the Port of Los Angeles, that delays all of their subsequent legs of their trip. So that congestion really feeds on itself. So a little bit of congestion can lead to a lot of headache.
Well, materials, they come on container ships, then they're hauled by trucks and eventually get to a warehouse of some kind where things have to be sorted and then eventually distributed. And you write a lot about Amazon, which has a lot of huge warehouses with really impressive amounts of automation. There are, I think, 115 of these so-called fulfillment centers in the United States where Amazon takes in a bunch of goods from all kinds of manufacturers and suppliers and then stores them and then is going to, as consumers ask for them, send them back out. Give us a sense of how these fulfillment centers, these warehouses functions, and the kind of automation we find there.
You go into this facility that is 1 million square feet. So it feels like the size of, you know, a very large sports stadium. And it is just full of automation. It's just miles and miles of conveyor, you know, robots of several descriptions, and then just tons and tons of people embedded in this system, kind of gluing together all these, you know, what engineers call islands of automation. And it's just this incredibly sophisticated process. From the moment that goods arrive on the shipping dock, they have to be ingested into the warehouse, which means that human beings are scanning each one of these items, the, you know, the UPC code on it, and they are dropping them into bins, which are then carried by conveyor to human beings known as stowers. And so a stower is standing at a station. They're doing it for 10 hours a day with a couple of breaks. All that that person does is these bins full of goods arrive on one side on a conveyor. They're grabbing those goods and they're stuffing them into these tall, soft-sided shelves, which are themselves on top of robots. And the software that manages this warehouse knows where every single item has been placed in any of those shelves atop any of those drive units. So when you order an item, let's say it's a hairbrush or something, within 45 minutes, one of these robot shelves that previously had that item put on it, you know, and it could be as little as a day's or a week ago, drives up to another human. It's doing that whole process in reverse, and that person is called a picker. And, you know, something pops up on a screen and it's like, grab this hairbrush, which is on this shelf, on this drive unit that has just been driven up to you. And so they're reaching in really quickly, taking the item out and just as quickly dropping it into a yellow bin, which then is carried away on a conveyor. And that is the heart of these automated warehouses. It's this symphony of humans working not just alongside machines, but really intimately with them. And so that means, of course, that the human has to work at the pace of the machine. And this is why we hear so many reports about people getting repetitive stress injuries in these jobs and high turnover and workers trying to unionize, because the pace is dictated by software, and any individual stower or picker can be fed items at whatever rate the machinery is capable.
What the rate is something that humans decide. I mean, the software doesn't decide that. And, you know, when you were describing this, you were saying that in order not to be written up, the standard is you have to be faster than the bottom 25% of the workers doing that job. Is that right?
Yes. And that is, of course, a floating rate, right? Because that's going to change day to day.
Right. But I guess that what troubles me about that is that essentially you're saying that by definition, 1 out of 4 of the workers is always underperforming. And they're being told it. And so they're naturally going to try to speed up. So I would just tend to create this constant pressure to speed up if you want to keep the job. God, it just sounds grueling.
I mean, they have turnover above 100% at these warehouses typically, which means that, you know, 100% of those workers on average are going to be gone after 1 year. So Are there enough people for them to continue hiring? I mean, that's one reason that they have instituted these $3,000 hiring bonuses. And now, you know, wages are going up to at least $18 an hour for these Amazon workers in the warehouses. That attracts a lot of people. Sometimes it even attracts people to come back seasonally. But that's been Amazon's approach rather than changing the pace of work.
Let's just talk a little bit about the disruptions that we've seen since the pandemic. This is a big, complicated subject, but I'm sure you followed it. I mean, these problems are going to be with us for a while, do you think?
I think that the supply chain problems we're having now, which are at the root of current inflation, are going to persist for a long time. And part of that is because we just have more demand for goods, and that seems to be, persistent. And part of that is because we're just ordering more stuff online, and we're ordering more stuff in different ways through e-commerce. And the other part of it is that we live in a world now where it's not just about pandemics, right? This news gets missed because Delta and Omicron and all the rest kind of swamp it. But there have been all kinds of disasters, natural disasters, extreme weather, political issues, which have shut down ports and factories all over the world. Malaysia got shut down, and this is a key link in the global semiconductor supply chain. Because of COVID, that was months ago. Well, a lot of those facilities have been shut down again because of severe flooding in Malaysia. So what happens is these single points of failure can get hit by all kinds of different disasters. And then you wake up tomorrow and unexpectedly lumber prices are really high, or you can't get a new car because one microchip was missing. So I think that these intermittent kind of outages are going to persist for a very long time. It's kind of just the nature of global supply chains now.
Well, Christopher Mims, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christopher Mims is a science and technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Arriving Today, From Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. I'm Terry Gross.